Dorothy Sayers is an excellent author to discuss as a person who embodies the very kind of incarnational theology that we talked about in Dante. Because I think the very fact that she took so much time to study Dante, to learn Italian, to go to all the real trouble of translating a long poem that had been translated by many, many other people before her, and took the time to write very copious notes and introductions to the three books of the Divine Comedy. I think this says something about her particular feeling of responsibility toward her Christian faith, that she didn't assume that you simply accepted it and said, well, that's lovely. I'm so glad people have really suffered and sweat over this so that I can have the truth for my own cup of tea in my own little apartment. Instead of that, she had the strife of burning vision that Dante himself had, that this truth had been so watered down and made so anemic that the general public, if there is such a person, has completely lost the initial scandal of the gospel. And her, I think the bulk of her writings are really like what Socrates called himself, a gadfly. That's the way you feel about her writing. She really was continually trying to poke people and say, look, you know, you can't take it that for granted. You can't be so casual about it. Christianity is a bombshell. It's an explosive. Don't just shrug your shoulders at it, or take it very piously, fold your hands and bow your head and swallow your Eucharistic bread and wine and say, you know, that's it, I've got it. Because you haven't. And if there's anything that I think that she really is a preacher in her writing. She has a real burden of a message that she is concerned to communicate. I'm going to read this bit from her introduction, which the introduction is written by the man who edited this particular edition of a collection of her works, Christian Letters to a Post-Christian World. I don't think it's still in print. It's edited by Roderick Jellema, who was a professor of English at the University of Maryland, and we used it for our lay seminar in language in 1970, which was right after it came out. Since that time, Erdmans, who published this particular edition, has come out with another collection, which is a little bit easier for people to, I guess, absorb, and it's also in a much more attractive format, and so on, and it's called A Matter of Eternity, Selections from the Writings of Dorothy Sayers, chosen and introduced by Rosamund Kent Sprague, who is a professor of classics at, I think, the University of South Carolina. And because of this, I think, because this book came out, I think this other book, Christian Letters to a Post-Christian World, has rather dropped into the out of print group. But if you ever run into this, it's an excellent, really an excellent collection. It came out first in hardback and then in paperback. And we've got a few more in paperback, and they were, I think, $6.95. Although this one originally was $3.95. So you can see the problems. The publishing houses have their difficulties. You can't always just lower the boom on them either. But Mr. Jellema quotes from Dorothy Sayers in the introduction to this particular little collection. And this is what he says. He asks the question, what does this collection of essays prove? Dorothy Sayers would probably answer that question the way she answered it in another context. And this is from Dorothy L. Sayers. You will probably be tempted by your habit of mind to ask, what does all this prove? It does not, in the scientific sense of the word, prove anything. The function of imaginative speech is not to prove, but to create, to discover new similarities, and to arrange them to form new unities, to build new self-consistent worlds out of the universe of undifferentiated mind stuff. Now you can say, well, that certainly didn't prove much to me, because that was a lot of words pushed together that I'm not used to putting together in that context. But perhaps it's sufficient to say that the important thing to remember here is the word that we used when we were discussing the imagery, the images, and the way in which you use images in writing, particularly amongst this group of Christian writers, that you may come in and you can pull that chair out if you want to sit elsewhere, you don't have to sit in the middle of the floor. That the exciting word to remember about all works of Christian imagination, particularly this group of people, is the word to discover or discovery. That it doesn't get unrolled or something, but you come upon it, it surprises you with its discovery. And that's I think an important attitude of mind to have towards all of these things, because then you are the one that enters into it. It's got to be your discovery. It isn't somebody telling you about something. I mean, it's not like reading a geography book about Magellan's discoveries or Columbus's discovery or Ponce de León's attempt to discover the fountain of youth or what have you. This is a discovery that you have to make yourself. It's a personal experience of discovery. And this is what she refers to when she says, this is the function of imaginative speech, to create and to discover new similarities, to arrange, to form them into new unities. In other words, you're not taking new ideas, you're not having a scientific explosion of finding out how you split the atom or anything like that. You're taking a lot of old traditional truths that you've known probably in the back of your mind for as long as you can remember, and restructuring them, rearranging them, finding new relationships, new similarities, and in doing this, you discover a whole new meaning in your own life and in your own understanding of life on this planet and eventually in the dimension of eternity. So it's very important to think about this as discovery, and that discovery is something that you enter in on yourself. That is, you have to be aware of this. You don't just sleep along into discovery. You really are keyed up to it, alert to it, attentive to it. And all these words are continually repeated by Charles Williams, certainly, by Dorothy Sayers, by Lewis, by Tolkien, if you read his essays, that this isn't just a happenstance, that discovery is one of the qualities of being a human being. You're not a dog that just wanders around by instinct and smells his way, but you actually discover because you've got a head on you that moves into new areas. I thought we'd start with a little devotion first. So you'll just think a little bit and meditate, and I'll read this to you. It's for an evening service, but I thought it's all right for morning too. The day that nature gave is ending, the hand of man turns on the light. We praise thee, progress, for defending our nerves against the dreadful night. As o'er each continent and island, the switches spread synthetic gain. The noise of mirth is never silent, nor dies the strain of toil away. We thank thee that thy speed incessant provides upon this whirling ball no time to brood on things unpleasant, no time, in fact, to think at all. Secure amid the soothing riot of crank and soundtrack, plane and car, we shall not be condemned to quiet, nor left alone with what we are. By lavish and progressive measures, our neighbor's wants are all relieved. We are not called to share his pleasures, and in his grief we are not grieved. Thy winged wheels o'erspan the oceans, machining out the standard man. Our food, our learning, our emotions are processed for us in the can. All bars of color cast in nation must yield to movies and the mic. We need not seek communication, for thou dost make us all alike. So be it. Let nor sleep nor slackness impede thy progress, light sublime. Nor ever let us glimpse the blackness that yawns behind the heat of time. The Collect for the Third Sunday in Cacophony. O misconstruction, that art the author of heat and lover of friction, in juggling with whom standeth our perpetual strife, and whose service is stark unreason. Assist us, thy aggressive shock troops, in all our assaults upon accuracy, that we, being practiced in giving offense, may not fear the power of any argument through the slight of thy misleading words. Amen. Now, the reason I read those to you was to make you realize that Dorothy Sears was not a writer who was not able to take off on something that was sacrosanct and holy. And she was able to do it with a great deal of cleverness. It takes real wit and real ability to know how to do the other side if you're going to take off on something. I mean, nobody can sing falsely or off tune as well as someone who knows what the right tune is. You see, you have to know the real thing. Now, I sing off tune quite often because I don't have a very good ear, and so I usually try to stand next to people that sing. The sing on tune, but you know, it's not hard for me to sing off tune without knowing that I'm singing. Now that's true, but you see, that isn't nearly as effective as someone who knows the slight nuances that you go into if you want to really get off tune and really bother somebody who has a good ear for music. And this is what she's saying. The Collect for the Third Sunday. She says that she has a sermon for Cacophony Tide reprinted from the Shizminster Parish Magazine, and Parish is spelled P-E-R-I-S-H. And the pastor writes a letter to his parishioners, and he says, "My little parishers." And then he calls Wishmas is the festival of Christmas, Wishmas. This festival, which is almost everywhere superseded the superstitious commemoration of Christmas, is celebrated by domestic agglomerations and by the exchange of cards bearing wishes for the recipient's material prosperity, and frequently adorned with ice, snow, holly, and other polar symbols. Yeah, St. Clement. What is that melody, Nancy?
We did it once. We did a Vespers one. We sang it. I think about the third stanza.
Yeah. It takes a little while before people begin to catch on to it, but... another thing she says, for example, is Saint Supercilia about the year 1400 was a maiden of remarkable erudition who steadfastly refused to marry anyone who could not defeat her in open disputation. The best scholars of all the universities in Europe had tried and failed. Her unworthy father brutally commanded her To accept the hand of a man who, though virtuous, sensible, and of a good estate, knew only 6 languages and was weak in mathematics. At this, the outraged saint raised her eyebrows so high that he lifted her right off her feet and out through a top-story window when she was last seen floating away in a northerly direction. Finally, she sounds a little bit like the leaping brilliant. Saint Supercilia is the patroness of pedants. Her feast, Eyebrow Sunday, falls in cacophony between Lowbrow Sunday and Derogation Day. This is just a sort of a little calendar she has. The polar year is divided into 8 seasons. Advertisement, or a season of solemn preparation leading up to the birth of science, which is the winter solstice. This is the polar year. Is followed by cacophony, which of course you see is a takeoff on Epiphany, which extends from circumlocution to derogation day, after which Trash Wednesday brings us to the pestilential season of umbrage. Then comes the great equinoctial feast of the Enlightenment, whose season ends on Civilization Sunday. The season of compression, devoted to the celebration of the masses in urbanity, begins with Ignition Sunday and ends in explosion. Immediately after comes the theophany of the spirit of progress, commonly called Petrol Sunday. Well, now, you know, what do people think about in the summertime, you know? I mean, after all, you keep your gas tank filled, don't you? That's the season of the petrol. That's the season of the gas tank, which marks the summer solstice. After the brisk series of Sundays in petrol, briefly interrupted by the Feast of the Unholy Name, we break out into expansion, which lasts from Bank Holiday, first Monday in August, to Exhaust Sunday and All Hallows. Remember, we talked about All Hallows Eve. All Hallows, celebrated at the autumn equinox. The Sunday following, Pole Star Sunday, devoted to the cult of isolation, ushers in the season of polarity, a period of peculiar and awful sanctity in which the cycle of the year completes its revolution. Now, actually, if you were to go through that calendar, you would find that she had very carefully picked words that had a definite relationship with the real liturgical name. Yeah?
What is derogation?
Well, derogation is something that pulls you down rather than seeking something that leads you up. A rogation Sunday is a Sunday for prayer and petitions. And derogation is just the opposite. Anything that would push you away from that sort of thing is a derogation. I don't think I've ever heard it used. Have you ever heard that used, Nancy, except your Derogation Sunday? I mean, I know it. I know that the name itself isn't used, but I mean, I really have not. I've heard you use the term derogatory, but I don't think I've heard terms of derogation. I have not heard that as a general. It's not a common expression. But she uses it simply to equal with Rogation Sunday, which is part of the Anglican festivals, not so much for us.
That's umbrage.
Well, that's the season for her. It would be this. It's the season of Lent, but you don't take umbrage at something. That means you don't take don't take offense at something. You see, so that the pestilential season of umbrage, in which you really do, it's just a series of offenses, instead of the absolute opposite, which Ash Wednesday instead of Trash Wednesday brings us to the pestilential season, and pestilential instead of penitential, you see, you get a complete, you have just these, and it takes a good deal of sophistication, you might say, to know this. But really, you know, it isn't so much sophistication as it is just being awake to what's being said, so that you even can ask the question as to what it means. You know, I have I'm not saying that in any accusing way, because I have the same problem exactly. It's very easy to just go along and take it for what it's worth. Well, that's just a little bit to give you an idea that she was not by any means without her own very lively sense of humor, which she was not averse to using, and using it to poke fun at people. But basically, I think her general writing is much better than this little bit of satire and humor that she uses, because she has such a vigor and fire in what she's saying, and so concerned that it be communicated, that she does it more than Lewis or Williams or Tolkien or any of them. She's much more of a preacher in the way she comes across. So that you, when you read anything by Dorothy Sayers, you're brought up pulled up straight to say, look, you know, she must be talking to me. And I want to read something from her, one of her essays on I think it's called the dogma, the greatest drama ever staged, is the official creed of Christendom. This is the dogma. She said, this is the outline of the official story. She tells about how, you know, the basic trimmed down facts of Christianity. The tale of the time when God was the underdog and got beaten, when he submitted to the conditions he had laid down and became a man like the men he had made, and the men he had made broke him and killed him. This is the dogma we find so dull, this terrifying drama of which God is the victim and the hero. If this is dull, then what in heaven's name is worthy to be called exciting? The people who hanged Christ, never to do them justice, accused him of being a bore. On the contrary, they thought him too dynamic to be safe. It has been left for later generations to muffle up that shattering personality and surround him with an atmosphere of tedium. He had very efficiently pared the claws of the Lion of Judah, certified him meek and mild, and recommended him as a fitting household pet for pale curates and pious old ladies. I want to read something from A Man Born to Be King, because it's really, this is exactly the same, on the same vein. Man Born to Be King is in print. It is available. It is a long series of radio plays on the life of Christ, and I cannot recommend anything that I would say would be more beneficial for your intellectual climate and the extension of your horizons as a Christian than to recommend this book and suggest that you read it. For instance, I read it when I first time I had ever seen it. I read it as an Advent book. I usually try to take a book during one of the seasons of the church year and take that as a book to read besides the scriptures. And I read this book, and I was really breathless with wonder at what it did to my understanding of the Gospels. What scope and what depth and intensity came in this particular series. She wrote them during the war as radio plays to it was kind of a morale builder for the British, but they are specifically Christian. They're all they don't drag a lot of, you know, yeah, rah rah for England or anything like that into it. She just went very, very carefully and meticulously into the sources as far as she was able, and studied the background so that she could write a good drama of the life of Christ. And it did come off very well. And I'm going to read this little part to you from the, she has introductions sort of like Bernard Shaw's introductions to his plays, which are very lengthy but very important, very interesting essays in understanding what the play is about, and also in your own growth of it. This is the introduction to the whole play, not just the introduction to one particular part of it. She's talking about the problem with the English of the authorized version, although she loves it, and she's not one for, you know, ringing the bell for using any old translation. At that time, we didn't have very many modern or contemporary translations, but she does feel that there's a real problem for us, because we just kind of are lulled asleep by the King James Version, and people were concerned about the way in which she had written this play, that it was far too contemporary, and it was really too slangy. Well, she said, there's a misty, pleasant, picturesque obscurity which people miss when they complain, in the words of one correspondent, that in the modern presentation, the atmosphere created seems so different from that of the original story, where it is all so impressively and wonderfully told. You know, that's the way we feel. You know, we like to have it impressive and wonderful, just so it doesn't hit us too hard. Just don't let it get into my vernacular, because then I just might have to be faced with something. So it is. The question is, are we, at this time of day, sufficiently wondering and impressed? Are we sufficiently wondering and impressed? Above all, are we sufficiently disturbed by this extremely disturbing story? You know, I really think, you know, we do have to pray a lot and regularly that the newness of the life of Christ and his being in the world does not disappear from us. That we don't, by our very familiarity with all of the, even the imaginative elements, which I'm giving you now, they can also be, finally, we get turned off by them, and then who's going to save us? It's like becoming immune to an antibiotic. I mean, there's no way you're going to ever get back, because you've heard it all. Still doesn't send me. Oh, you know, you might just have to have a good big dose, another dose of the Holy Spirit, because he's the only one that can waken us to a renewed understanding of who Jesus Christ is for us. So don't ever think that you've arrived. I've got it. You know, I've got it. I don't have to think anymore. I don't have to move anymore. Nothing ever is going to happen to me anymore, because I'm saved, period. Well, Dorothy Sayers doesn't let you think about that with any degree of satisfaction. She said, are we really disturbed by this extremely disturbing story? Sometimes the blunt new word will impress us more than the beautiful and old. Now, this is an example that I have. Now, I've read this. I must have read this at least 2 or 3 times. But you know, and here I am, 62 now, and I brag about being wide awake, you know, and you know, wow, you gotta be intellectually alert, bang, bang, bang. Now, I've read this over and over again. I never saw this one particular line. I asked Carol about it, and I said, I didn't even remember this in the Greek. Sometimes the blunt new word will impress us more than the beautiful and old. All right, this is a quote. Except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man, said Jesus. And then, seeing perhaps that the reaction to this statement was less vigorous than it might have been, he repeated it, but this time using a strong and rather vulgar word meaning, quote, to eat noisily like an animal. Chew, munch, crunch, tap, chomp. I mean, she puts all these little words in afterwards. Then she says, but in the end, I was pusillanimous and left it at eat, not liking to offend the ears of the faithful with what Christ actually said. Yeah. Really weak. Well, you know, I said to Carol, I don't remember that. I don't remember that there's a different word. for eating. In that, I mean, I know that, for instance, I know that that's true in the language. You know, those of you who know German remember that Essen and Fressen are very close together, but they mean two different things. You don't talk about Fressen if you're talking about a person. You know, that's an animal with his teeth grinding away at a bone. And Jesus uses a term like this in order to make them realize that this is an actual thing that they're going to do. It's an actual physical, an act, not just a symbolic little wafer that melts and you hardly know it's there.
What verse was that again? Where is that?
Well, that's from, except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man, you have no life in you. It's in John.
Mm-hmm.
But this she uses simply to explain why she was so concerned in the man born to be king, to make the work directly involved as possible with her readers and hearers. You see, these people are listening over the radio, and as she says, they're, some of them are going to hear it in a sequence. The plays only occurred every month. And so she said she was really concerned because she felt that that each play had to be a unit in itself and really deliver a punch. And she wanted it to awaken people to the fact that this was a disturbing story, this life of Christ. This is not just something, you know, bland and a soporific or an opium of the people or anything like that. It was a revolutionary kind of thing, and she was concerned that this occur. So when she wrote the play, she wrote it with that in mind. Now I want I'm going to read one more thing from her and then go to the man born to be king, because I want you to get an idea of the way in which she structured the play. I'm not going to read parts of it because you really can't stop any place because there's so many good sections in it. But I want to read some of the parts of her introductory essay because they clarify for you how she understood her challenge in writing this, and why it takes a great deal of intellectual sweat to write this kind of thing. Oh, well, I'll get to that, but she has such a sense of the deep, God-given kind of responsibility that we have as human beings who have been exposed to some training in order to communicate this great message in some way or other that will really meet the need of the people in the society in which we live. We can't just, as I said before, we can't shrug our shoulders about it. This is a job that we have. And she certainly is one person that comes across with it.
Lewis is way to glory.
Has that, definitely, right. Very much. She says this about the problem with people that insist on dogma, that complain about an insistence on dogma, and that it just makes people fight and get, you know, irritated at each other. And why can't we all be sweet and peaceful and loving? And after all, we all know what the golden rule is, and of course we all obey it because it's a rule. And so, why bother? First, I believe it to be a grave mistake to present Christianity as something charming and popular, with no offense in it. Seeing that Christ went about the world giving the most violent offense to all kinds of people, it would seem absurd to expect that the doctrine of his person can be so presented as to offend nobody. We cannot blink at the fact that gentle Jesus, meek and mild, was so stiff in his opinions and so inflammatory in his language that he was thrown out of church, stoned, hunted from place to place, and finally gibbeted as a firebrand and a public danger. Whatever his peace was, it was not the peace of an amiable indifference. And he said in so many words that what he brought with him was fire and sword. That whatever his peace was, it was not the peace of an amiable indifference. And he said in so many words that what he brought with him was fire and sword. That being so, nobody need be too much surprised or disconcerted at finding that a determined preaching of Christian dogma may sometimes result in a few angry letters of protest or a difference of opinion on the parish or the council. I had to borrow Nancy Winder's book because mine was in Seattle, and I have to laugh because she's got all these passages underlined for me, so I don't have to I didn't even have to put any checks in the margins because they were already underlined. See what an inflammatory writer she is, you know? She just throws these firecrackers in your backpack, and before you know, you've got to start exploding all over the place. But it's fun. It was really fun to read this, because it was Nancy's. I want to, as I said, I want to tell you a little bit about the problem that there is in writing some kind of a dramatic exposition of the life of Christ. You know, there are so many attempts to make this drama, you know, the greatest story ever told, and the robe, and oh goodness, you could pull bodice. There are just hundreds and hundreds of things that have been written either as a result in terms of the time, immediate time area of Christ's life and death and resurrection, but also of the actual events. Now we saw half of that TV production of the life of Christ, and as Carol said, the amazing thing was that the real offense which came in the time when Jesus was in the synagogue preaching, and he uses the examples of the people on the outside of the Jewish race as examples of where the mission was going to go, that was left out of the film. Now, why? You can't really understand, because that was the reason they were furious. And all the way through, for instance, in John, when he talks to them about the fact that their father is not Abraham but the devil, and that before Abraham was, I am, and that if they're going to be actually a part of his kingdom, they're going to have to realize that it's not their Jewishness that's going to get them in there. And this kind of offensiveness on the part of Jesus with his own people is a real thing. We really have pared the claws of the line of Judah for ourselves so that he's not offensive to us. I mean, who wants to be offended in Jesus? He's so nice. You know, he's so forgiving. He's so loving. Of course he is, but we forget that the forgiveness sometimes comes out of long and struggling, like Ronnie talked about last night. I mean, it's so simple, and yet it's so hard to come to it. And yet, because we want to take it as a little pill, you know, I'll feel good, I'll get over my headache, I'll get over my sins, I'll take a pill, you know. It's not that kind of thing. There's a deep involvement with the gospel and the relationship with Christ that is a real offense. And I think lots of times as young people, we're not always aware of it. And yet, if you take it seriously and if you grow in it, you'll see why Jesus was called, and the gospel is called in Greek, the skandalo, the scandal. And we don't think of it in terms of scandal. It's a trap, it's a bait, it's everything that you don't want it to be. You want it to be sweetness and light and beauty and loveliness and him singing instead of the cross, which was a tormented kind symbol for us to have as our center. Well, I want to take this, show you these how she structures her play, because it's really interesting, and it gives you a feeling of, I think it gives you a feeling of real respect for the kind of work that's involved in producing something like this, and why it takes intellectual sweat and energy to do it, to make something like this come across. She talks about the structure of the play and how important it is to get this kind of play so that it will come across consistent with the truth, but in a contemporary medium that will address itself to the 20th century. And she says here, from the linguistic material, in other words, she as I mentioned, you know, she thought about using the word for an animal eating the flesh of the son of man, and she decides not to. But she does use other things. She changes a lot of the words so that they can be used in terms of a microphone, a radio, and also so that they will be communicated as a 20th century kind of conversation and play. Then she said we go from the linguistic material to the architectural material. Now, by architectural material, she means the structure of the play, the way the play is built. And it has an architecture. It's not just a hit and miss thing. If you know anything about the way in which plays are written, you know they have to have things that keep them together. They have to have a unity in the events that take place. You have to have a consistency in the characters. You've got to have lines of plot that pull things back and forth so that you aren't left with a feeling of, huh? What do you mean? It doesn't come across. So she thinks this through ahead of time, and that's what is really good about this introduction. And in the introduction, by the very way in which she writes it, it becomes an intellectual essay in spiritual understanding. You really get a feeling of insight and depth that you didn't have before. The structure of the gospel drama is interesting, up to and including the crucifixion. It has, as I have said, the strict form of classical tragedy, though not of what Aristotle would consider a tragedy of the best type, for it depicts the fall of a good man to undeserved misfortune, and this he reckons only the second worst of the four possible forms. Aristotle, of course, believed that all good plays, the hero had to be, was a great person, and the hero was somebody that you could look at with a sense of wonder and awe, how good he was, and that when he is when his life goes through, that you would never have him fall to such undeserved misfortune. He's got to have a flaw. If he's got a flaw, then you can see that he's going to be at the beck and call of the fates. But this man, this Jesus, he doesn't have a flaw. How are you going to make him into a hero? That really has an excitement to the way in which, an excitement in the way in which he's involved in his life story. Nor would Aristotle have altogether approved the character of the protagonist, for the hero of a tragedy should be a mixed character, neither perfectly good nor perfectly bad. The hero is indeed one of the major difficulties in this particular drama, since perfect goodness is apt to be unsympathetic, and generally speaking permits of little development. Now this is the part that I want you to listen to, particularly. I mean, I know it's hard to follow when somebody's reading to you and you get sleepy, but I want you to pay attention to this particularly. This hero's goodness was not of a static kind. He was a lively person. He excited people. Wherever he went, he brought not peace, but a sword and fire in the earth. That is why they killed him. He said surprising things in language ranging from the loftiest poetry to the most lucid narrative and the raciest repartee. If we did not know all his retorts by heart, if we had not taken the sting out of them by incessant repetition in the accents of the pulpit with the preacher tone, and if we had not somehow, I put that in, and if we had not somehow got it into our heads that brains were rather reprehensible, we should reckon him among the greatest wits of all time. Nobody else in three brief years has achieved such an output of epigram. You know, he really is terrific. But it's like I said, you know, the parables are there, the images are there for you to think about, but we don't need to think about them. They've been preached to us. They're all explained. I know the answers. And we haven't even asked a question, you know? Because the reason we don't ask the question is because we never are confronted by Jesus Christ. We're always confronted by all these derivatives, all these things that, you know, have happened since, and people have said this about and about and about, and so that's what we read. But we don't really allow the scripture itself to involve us so that we get pulled up by our bootstraps and say, oh, that must be me. And then
we didn't really see, Mary, that, you know, we talked last night, that the first human being's autobiography is written in the margins of the Bible.
Well, you could say that, certainly, that, that your autobiography is written in the margin of your Bible.
And if it's empty.
And if there's no, if there are no marginal notes, physically or not physically, but I think you just about have to read the Bible with a pen or pencil. I don't think you can read scripture and just, you know, never underline a thing and say, oh, I don't want to deface that beautiful page. Baloney, you know. I think if that, then they have really made an idol out of that book. But when you are able to really put question marks, exclamation marks, wow, or no, on the sides, this is impossible, any old thing, I mean, go ahead, write it in, you know, and you get at least involved. You don't have to make a speech on it, but at least there's, you know, there's some little points of mileposts along the way. He suffered misfortune because he was what he was and could not be otherwise. And since his time tragedy has become the tragedy of will and character and not of an external and arbitrary destiny. And this is important, that we are not, since Jesus Christ, we are not the flotsam and jetsam of the waves of fate. We are the result of will and character as we see ourselves before God. And this is a really important thing to say. Thus far, then, a classical tragedy could end with, and most of them did, you know, because after all, a tragedy, how does a tragedy end? Sad. You know, it's going to end in a hole. My goodness, you think of any of the Greek tragedies, you know, none of them come out right. They're always bloody, bloody bad at the end. Well, this one was bloody bad too, but then what happens? But in the fifth act, there occurs a peripeteia, again of the classical kind. The hero is recognized for what he is, and this doesn't happen in an orthodox kind of tragedy. Immediately, what was the blackest human tragedy turns into the divine comedy. You see why Dante called his work that? Because, as I told you last fall, I'm sure you don't remember, but when I gave you the first lecture we had on the Christian imagination, and I talked about Tolkien and what he says at the conclusion of his wonderful essay on fairy stories, in which he says, and the wonderful thing is that the catastrophe, which is always the conclusion of most stories, a very terrifically, you know, exciting thing, but, you know, it's likely to end in something bad. And that's what usually the Greek tragedies, of course, always had to end that way. But Tolkien says what we have in the Christian story is a catastrophe, a good catastrophe, that suddenly ends in, wow, there's an answer to all this. And, as she says, the hero is recognized for what he is, and the blackest human tragedy turns into divine comedy. Now then, she says, is it possible to have a Christian tragedy? Well, from the earthly end, mankind, haunted from the womb to the grave by a hamartia, and you know hamartia in Greek means the word for sin, which is missing the mark, really. That's the way the the Greeks it really isn't all that good, I don't think, a good explanation for what we understand as sin, because sin is seems deeper than that. But anyway, it sets him at odds with himself, with society, and with the very nature of things, so that every action is fraught with tragic significance. And you feel that the problem with any Christian who is living in a, if you're going to try to make a tragedy out of it, you find that eventually his worst sins are redeemable by his worst suffering. His evil is not merely purged. It is in the literal sense made good. Pardon me. The iron necessity that binds him is the working of the divine will. And lo, the gods are friendly. That's, he's using the Greek term, but you know, it's what we understand. All of a sudden we realize, you know, God really loves us. And this is the amazing fact. Well, she says, short of damnation, it seems, there can be no Christian tragedy. Indeed, if a man is going to write a tragedy of the classic type, he'd better leave Christianity out of it. At least it will not do to introduce a complete Catholic theology. That is, by Catholic she means the total theology of the Christian Church. And this is a line that I think you might like to write down, because I hadn't remembered this one either. I don't know if Dancy had or not, but I think it's a great one. Where Christ is, cheerfulness will keep breaking in. Where Christ is, cheerfulness will keep breaking in. And I don't like to use Ronnie as an example too much, but I just kept thinking to myself, you know, it's true, the Holy Spirit gives you a sense of humor. And what looks like tragedy to persons on the outside, you know, Christ just keeps bumping in and you can't help but, you know, it you get cheerful again. I mean, you want to feel sorry for yourself. You really want to nurse your wounds. You want to pat your Achilles heel. You know, pull the scab off so it hurts some more and make everybody feel badly while you limp. And you know, it's amazing. He just, all of a sudden, he snaps his fingers and you say, what a fool I am, you know. Where Christ is,
Mary?
What, no.
Achilles,
that's just not anything. But I think this is wonderful. Where Christ is, cheerfulness will keep breaking in. I think that's a neat statement. And I think it's important to remember this. Now then, there's another, she goes on with this idea of cheerfulness, because she says, you know, it's very hard to understand too, when she said, now, this is, we really don't have any real Christian tragedies. We can't have them, because there's always the ending of the gospel. No matter what you do, you can't end it with a negative. And she said, the funny thing is that the disciples of Jesus, plunged into cowardice and despondency by the human tragedy of the crucifixion, needed only to be convinced by the resurrection that which had suffered and died, she uses the word that, not person, that which had suffered and died was, in actual historical fact, the true being of all things, to recover their courage and spirits in a manner quite unparalleled, and to proclaim the divine comedy loudly and cheerfully with the utmost disregard for their own safety. Why and how the suffering of God should have this exhilarating effect upon the human spirit is a question for atonement theology. Now, you know, I think this is something, see, we don't ask questions like that usually. No, we just take for granted, yeah, right. No, we're saved. Well, sure, we're glad. But, you know, you think of what Jesus went through. And we've just gone through Lent, and you know, it's very easy, all of a sudden, in the space of one night, practically, we're singing Easter songs, hallelujah, hooray, you know, he's on our side, we won, and forgot all about it. And she says, you know, this is an amazing thing, this happened to the disciples. They just, all of a sudden, loudly and cheerfully, they begin proclaiming the remarkable fact of the resurrection. This statement that she makes here, I think, is another one that's important in her understanding of the theological basis for the play, and which is part of her understanding of the architectural structure of the play. To those first apostles, the resurrection seemed important, not because it held out a promise of personal survival, St. Peter's Pentecostal sermon contains nothing about pie in the sky when you die. It was important, and she has this italicized, because it established the identity of the slain. Because it established the identity of the slain. What does that mean? Can anybody tell me? What does it mean? Because it established the identity of the slain. That the resurrection was important, not because of personal immortality or life after death, but why? Because it established the identity of the slain. What does that, what do those words mean? Now, don't think about it. Don't think about it in a big fancy way. What do the words mean? Because it, the resurrection, established the identity of the slain. I can hear you.
It proved he was the Son of God.
It proved the identity of the slain one, that he was the Son of God. And that the person that they were hanging on to was in real fact the only begotten of the Creator of the universe. Now that's a big deal. This is not personal survival. This is not immortality. This is not, you know, a great affirmation of life after death. I don't care what people say to you. I am the resurrection and the life. It had no meaning in terms of Martha, what he said to Martha. If it hadn't been authenticated by the Easter fact. And the Easter fact simply affirmed that he had a right to say it, because he really did rise from the dead. Okay, well, now then, I'm just going to take one of the characters in the play, because as she says, there are many, the beginning and the end of the play, and like anything, if you ever have tried to write a story, you know that the beginning and the end are not all that hard. It's the middle that's so difficult. And I guess that's why I like Auden's The Time Being. Because, you know, it's trying to redeem the time in between. You know, that when the excitement is there, well, that's great. And the excitement at the end, that's great. But, you know, what do you do with the piddliness of daily living, you know? That's what's hard. And that's also hard when you're writing a play. How do you make them, all that big, long period, be exciting that when Jesus was walking about doing good and preaching exercising demons and trying to teach his disciples a thing or two. How do you make that exciting? Well, she said, that's the problem with the middle of the play. And so she really has to think this thing through. As she said, the nativity story stands on its own. That's great. The passion plays, they are there, the entry into Jerusalem and all those great events and relationships that Jesus is involved in, those are all exciting. What do you do about the middle? You know? Well, she has a very interesting angle on this. She makes Judas the theme, one of the theme structures that pulls the play together. You know, the devil, blame him anyway, bless him. He's always got to be so important. You know, he's always, you know, moving around in Paradise Lost and even in the Divine Comedy, you know, he's the one you're finally going to see at the bottom of hell. And here he comes up again, you know, in the form of Judas. He's got to be important. But maybe it's all right, because after all, we do have to be aware of him, and usually we're pretty casual about his personality too. She says that the centering about the character of Judas helps to really put the whole play in focus. And she has an excellent characterization on the sort of the background of Judas and why she interprets him the way she does. And I'm going to read and talk about it with you, because I think it's important for you to understand it. And it also makes you realize that this writer, Dorothy Leigh Sayers, is a person who has plumbed the depths of a good deal of insight and understanding of the nature of evil. And she never quibbled about the fact that you learn about the nature of evil first from your own heart. Judas in the Gospels is an enigma. He is introduced suddenly at a late moment in the action, quote, all set for villainy. Now, you know, I can't remember, I looked it up and I couldn't find where he was enrolled in the disciple group. Apparently, as she interprets it, he was part of John the Baptist's group. We are not told how he came to be a disciple, nor what motives drove him to betray his master. St. John says he was a thief. He certainly took payment for his treason.